You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a new piece from WisContext that found regulations for search and rescue operations when a person goes missing vary a lot across the country. And we'll find out how they work here in Wisconsin. First, at some point in your work life, you've probably felt really busy, maybe even overwhelmed. Maybe that's how you always feel at work. We might see that as a good thing. It just shows how important we are and that we're getting a lot done. But hold on. Feeling busy all the time may make us worse at what we do. Journalist Bridget Schulte is the author of the book Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. She's director of the Better Life Lab at the public policy think tank New America. She recently wrote about the brain science of feeling busy for the BBC. Bridget, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, great to be with you.
Well, I know my brain feels different when I'm super busy, and not necessarily in a good way. You dug into some of the science behind that and this process called, I think it was tunneling. What's going on there?
Yeah, when I read about it, I don't know about you, but it felt very, very familiar. So think about it. You know, when you are really busy, what we're really experiencing is time scarcity, you know, the sense that we have too much to do and not enough time to do it in. And so that creates this sense of like almost like firefighting or panic. You know, we try to speed up. We've got so much to do. And then what was so interesting is that there's research that behavioral scientists are looking into this phenomenon around scarcity, whether it's scarcity of money and how that affects decisions that people make in poverty or scarcity of time. And what they're finding is that when we're in that kind of hyper panicked moment of scarcity, we actually end up making poor decisions. What ends up happening, think about it, they call it tunneling. And that when you tunnel, think about what happens to your vision. You're in this dark tunnel. It starts to narrow. And so in the work context, what we're finding is that you tend to be able to focus on a very narrow, kind of low value task right in front of you in the tunnel. And what that ends up happening for a lot of people is, I'm going to go to my email inbox. I got a lot to do there. And so you churn through all those emails. And at the end of the day, you feel productive because you've been busy, but you haven't really been doing your most important work.
It seems like evolutionarily, this tunneling, this focus on one thing could have a benefit. If there's one threat, one issue of scarcity, we can deal with it. If we can focus just on that, wonderful. But it sounds like from the research you write about in our modern lives, that tunneling does not point us toward that one thing.
But you're absolutely right. So tunneling can mean hyper-focus. And so if you're hyper-focused on the right thing, then that's great. You kind of lose yourself. You get the, you know, say you've got a big project, you hyper-focus on it, you're in the tunnel, you get it done. That's actually a great thing. You know, it lines up, what you do lines up with what your priorities are. But when what you do does not line up with what you value or what's most important, then you're tunneling on the wrong thing. And that's what trips so many of us up. We tunnel on the wrong thing.
And this is really important. It matches into what you've been researching, keeping yourself busy, researching a long time, that we are really and really feel busy a lot. Can you talk about our busy state of mind in 2020?
Well, you know, it's sort of two things. There is no doubt that this is an incredibly busy and distracting time. There's a lot of information coming at us, and it can kind of really weigh down our mental cognitive load, if you will. And there's just too much to pay attention to, and you kind of don't know where, so you're kind of going every which way, and it feels busy. You have a lot of demands on your time. People are juggling work and life, and you know, work demands are ratcheting up, and at the same time, expectations at home of what you should be able to do are ratcheting up. So there's no doubt that people are feeling busy, but what I've been looking at is that we tend to value that busyness in our country. I call it the busyness paradox, and other, you know, other research has looked into this as well. That when we value, say, the worker who is always on and answering those emails at 11 o'clock at night and never leaving the office, and we think, boy, that's the best worker. What we end up doing is we start replicating that. We work like them because we think that's valuable. And so we kind of create the environment where it's almost impossible not to be busy. We almost can't make a different choice because we've created an environment that so values at least the appearance of busyness.
But as I read this research you're talking about, not only are we, you know, making ourselves maybe look good if we're Johnny busy guy, our work output, the stuff we actually accomplish, may be worse as a result. Am I reading this right?
Well, that's what's so interesting. You know, think about it. It's almost like the old adage, everyone's busy, no one's productive. You know, that if you run around and you're answering your emails all day and you're, you know, flying from meeting to meeting and you're slamming doors and you're looking really busy, you know, you need to take a step back and think about, well, what is the work that you're supposed to be doing? You know, what is the value that you're bringing to that position? What do you need to produce at the end of the day or the end of the week? And if all of that busyness is not adding up to what you really need and want and should be doing, then you're just wasting your time.
Talking to Bridget Schulte. She's a journalist, author of the book Overwhelmed, talking about research she wrote about for the BBC on the ways that being busy, feeling busy, can actually make us less productive, worse workers, maybe worse in our daily lives, too. Bridget, I want to talk in a minute about what we as individuals can do, but do you see lessons here for business owners, managers in various institutions about how they handle workloads for their employees?
Yes, this is what's so important. That's a lot of the kind of the conversation around busyness tends to come back to the individual, like, oh, you made this choice, or you just need more willpower. And I think it's so important that business leaders and managers recognize it's really about the environment that they're creating at work, that people will respond to what you say you value and who gets the promotion. And, you know, do you send out emails about like, whoa, so-and-so is great. They work so hard. They were here till 11 o'clock last night. What are the messages that you're sending to your employees? Or do you send out messages like, wow, this project was really amazing, and look at all the people who worked on it, and so-and-so works remote, and so-and-so is taking care of their mom, and, you know, so-and-so is working part-time, and they did this amazing work. I think we really need to begin to divorce the idea that good work is only done when you put in long hours and you're physically present. You know, work has changed, our work style and technology has changed. It's time for our attitudes around what good work is to change as well.
Now, that said, in your piece in the BBC, there was some individual advice about how we schedule ourselves for the future. You know, the present day Rob might be mad at Rob of the past for loading up all these appointments or meetings or whatever for today. How can we avoid that scenario?
Well, you know, one of the best pieces of, advice, or just even a way of thinking about your time, that I thought was so powerful, it came from a behavioral scientist. And he said, you know, when we think about our schedule, you know, and you look at your calendar, or, you know, however you plan your time, we often think about it like the kitchen pantry. And if your pantry looks like mine, you shove more stuff in there. And I bet I can get this in there. And maybe there's outdated stuff, but there's just more and more stuff that you cram in there. And he said, rather than think about our schedule like the pantry that we shove more stuff onto, why don't we think about it like an art gallery, where we're very, you know, very intentional. We plan very carefully about how are we going to spend our time, and when are we going to do things, and, you know, how do we plan them in conjunction with what comes next, and to really be more thoughtful about, you know, what gets put on the wall. Not everything goes on the wall. You don't have to do everything. What's the most important things to do? And find a way to display that in your calendar.
And bringing things back to where we started, it seems like that idea of curating our time and effort could apply in that situation where you're at work right now, you're overwhelmed, you're hitting that tunneling moment. How can we step back and say, don't tunnel in on that apparently productive but irrelevant thing? How do I prioritize?
Yeah, that's honestly, I think one of the easiest things that we can all do is just take a moment and stop. Just pull yourself out of that tunnel. Take a breath in that moment. You know, maybe three deep breaths. You know, that actually has been proven scientifically to lower your cortisol levels and sort of bring you back to, like, you know, you're bringing your thought processes back online. Take that moment and really ask yourself, what do I really need to do today? What would feel great if I got this done by the end of the day? You know, and then set a timer. You know, it's always hard to do that hard thing, but the brain can do anything if it's in for a finite amount of time. So figure out what's the most important thing. Set your timer for 30 minutes and just dig in.
It's a good place to leave it. Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Oh, so great to talk to you.
That's journalist Bridget Schulte, who directs the Better Life Lab at the think tank New America. We talked to her about the ways that being too busy can be bad for us, based on a recent article she wrote for the BBC. You can find a link to the article on Central Time's webpage at WPR.org. I think I've taken some of this advice in the past at my job here. I have to do today the stuff that leads up to the on-air part of the day. And if you've got an email waiting for a reply from me from, I don't know, 2017, I do apologize. Coming up, volunteers are a crucial part of search and rescue operations when a person goes missing. But a new report from WisContext shows rules about their training are really different from one state to another. We'll find out more, including how it works here in Wisconsin, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up next, quitting can be the next step to a better life or a bittersweet goodbye. We'll talk about stories of quitting things like school, quitting chewing gum, even quitting. And we'll ask for your own stories. First, search and rescue operations are crucial when a person goes missing. Oftentimes, they're powered entirely by volunteers. They do vital and painstaking work, searching for evidence of a missing person, at times even helping to recover human remains. But in two new pieces for WisContext.org, our next guest found that the training for volunteers and the rules they operate under are really different from one state to another. Some states barely regulate them at all. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keely Baltina about the story earlier today.
Who makes up these search and rescue teams, and what are they deployed to do?
Yeah, there are a few counties in the state that have in-house professionalized search and rescue teams, but only a few of them. The vast majority of communities in the state, the search and rescue teams are volunteer-based. So it's volunteer organizers and volunteers who are out doing the search and rescues.
And what are they often searching for?
So it can really range anything from a missing person, whether it's someone who got lost in the woods, like a hiker or a camper, or sometimes a senior citizen, maybe with dementia or something, might wander away from a group home or something like that. But they also will search for possible human remains, dead bodies, if there's an idea that there might be one, perhaps in like a lake or the woods or something like that.
So there's quite a range. We saw this, I think, most high profile in, recently with the kidnapping of Jamie Kloss, and when people came out in full force to try to search for her. Where did we see the volunteers playing into that investigation?
Yeah, volunteers participated in that investigation in a couple ways. First, there was the pretty public search in the days after Jamie Kloss's disappearance, where the sheriff's department asked for 100 volunteers or so to help scour the local fields and ditches, collect potential evidence. That's a pretty typical response to a missing person case like that. That's pretty high profile. But less public was a request from the sheriff's department for volunteer search and rescue canine handlers. And several canine handlers did answer that call from neighboring counties, and they participated in a little bit quieter way, searching the vicinity around the Kloss home for potential evidence with the use of these scent tracking dogs that are really, really useful. And they did so under the guidance of law enforcement.
And I think I often assume that we're looking for people, but hitting on the fact that they're also looking for any shred of evidence that they can find is really key for these volunteers.
Totally. Yep.
You spoke with some of them. What did they have to say about why they do this? Because they don't get paid.
They don't get paid, no. It's all volunteers, and they often, not only do they not get paid, but they spend an awful lot of money sometimes on training, particularly for volunteer canine handlers. They have to spend thousands of dollars on training, hundreds of hours training their dogs and themselves. But really, it's a passion of a lot of these volunteers. It's kind of like a hobby turned passion. A lot of people get into it because they're interested in wilderness survival or tracking techniques or wilderness navigation, what have you, and then get kind of sucked into the world of search and rescue.
And realize that they can make a difference, that they can help.
Exactly. They can provide a public service.
It's sounds like different states have different levels of regulation when it comes to these volunteer search and rescue teams. We've got a couple of ends of the spectrum and then some folks in the middle there. Let's start with California, which regulates search and rescue operations pretty heavily.
They do, which I think a lot of people may not be surprised about that. California has a lot of regulations around a whole bunch of things,
right,
including search and rescue. And part of the reason for that in California is because search and rescue volunteers are dealing often with much more intense terrain than we find here in the Midwest, really mountainous and remote regions. So there's more requirements around training for search and rescue volunteers. There's more requirements around how sheriffs interact with each other when they're making requests for search and rescue volunteers. And there are more protections for those volunteers, financial protections, in the case that they get injured or die on a search.
Unsurprisingly, I think, if we assume that California fits into our understanding that it's more highly regulated, we see a lot less regulation in a place like Texas.
Yes. Again, kind of living up to stereotypes. In Texas. And so I got this information from the executive director of a national association for search and rescue volunteers. And he's actually based in Texas, so he has some local insight. In Texas, they do live up to their kind of like Wild West reputation. He said there's really no regulation. Search and rescue teams don't have to follow any particular training. They don't have to be affiliated with a sheriff's department, as they do in many states. They can ask for money. He said that this leads to kind of like competing teams in local areas. He said there are several competing teams in the Houston area, and sometimes they'll work just directly with families rather than the sheriff's department, so it can be really unorganized, and sometimes they'll then demand money. But there's a wide spectrum of teams in Texas.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext, and we're talking about his latest two pieces that look at search and rescue operations. Okay, now we know where Texas stands. We know where California stands. Where does Wisconsin land?
Wisconsin is pretty much in the middle, like a lot of states. So there are a few rules around volunteer search and rescue teams. They do have to be affiliated with the sheriff's department. There is protocol for how sheriffs can activate search and rescue team or ask for neighboring counties to provide their services through mutual aid. And also search and rescue, there's no specific training that's required by the state, but search and rescue teams do require, in Wisconsin, do require their own trainings, which are really quite rigorous.
So there's an amount of self-policing that happens within these volunteer organizations or these groups of people that may want to respond when they're asked.
Correct. But in Wisconsin, there aren't the financial protections for search and rescue volunteers as there are in California.
So there's a circumstance where you're dealing in dangerous circumstances, or it's night, or you trip and fall, or you get hurt. You're responsible for that because you're volunteering.
Yeah, you have to hope that your own health insurance will cover that. There's no entitlement to workers' compensation or death benefits for search and rescue volunteers, which is different from other kind of emergency response volunteers in the state. So volunteer firefighters, EMTs are entitled to those workers' comp and death benefits.
Mm, but not search and rescue.
Right.
Where in the state have we really professionalized or standardized those search and rescue operations?
It really just depends on maybe there's a really passionate organizer in some area. And that really is the case with the folks I spoke to. Sawyer County in northern Wisconsin really has a really quite professionalized crew of over 30 volunteers at any given time. And part of that is just because of the people up there who have been involved in search and rescue for decades, including county staff there who work on emergency management issues. And there are other groups like that around the state that are really quite professionalized. A lot of times they're also affiliated with canine tracking capabilities. They just have to be a little bit more trained. And a lot of those kind of are on the state line. So there's a group that does searches in Wisconsin, Minnesota, kind of in western Wisconsin, and then another group near the border with Illinois and another group near the border with UP.
Do we know what role state agencies play in search and rescue?
Really, search and rescue is a largely local endeavor. The state will get involved, like Wisconsin Emergency Management, will get involved if there's a request for aerial support. Usually that aerial support is more for like situational awareness to help provide the search and rescue volunteers on the ground with information that they might not be able to glean from being on the ground. But that's largely where the state comes in.
Do we know how successful search and rescue operations in Wisconsin are?
We don't, which is another issue that the gentleman I spoke to from the national organization said. Like, it's quite an issue when there's no tracking or recording mechanism across the state. So you don't know how successful the searches are. You don't know if they're are maybe issues that could be addressed from like kind of like systemic issues related to like is there like a certain demographic or like a certain area where people go missing or what have you. There are all sorts of potentially important and useful information that the state is just not gathering. And that does occur in some places like California.
Okay. So, but potentially an area that Wisconsin could improve.
Yes, exactly.
Will, this has been really enlightening. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keely Baltina about his two recent pieces looking at search and rescue operations in Wisconsin and around the country. If you want to read more about them, you can find both articles at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we're talking about stories of quitting a bad habit, a relationship, a job, whatever it may be. The New York Times collected 20 stories about quitting in all walks of life. We'll hear some of what they found out, and we want to hear your stories. You can get us started right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and let us know about something you quit, tried to quit, and whether it worked out well or not so well. Or you can even get on the phone right now at 800-642-1234. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the American Lung Association is out with its annual report looking at policies around the country on smoking and nicotine use. We'll talk to a Wisconsin representative of the group about how the state scored this year. First, quitters never win, and winners never quit. That's one way of looking at quitting, but there can be something about quitting that feels pretty good, maybe thrilling, even if it's difficult, scary, or feels uncertain. Usually it means change is coming your way, change that you have decided to initiate. We've seen some stories of quitting in the news lately with many Democratic presidential candidates deciding to walk away from their run, even Prince Harry and wife Meghan Markle walking away from the royal life. I want to hear your stories of quitting at 800-642-1234. Have you quit something in your lifetime, big or small, a job, a career, a bad habit? Maybe you're a big soda drinker and you stopped or tried. Maybe you walked away from college. Maybe you sold your car and only biked to work. Whatever it might be, we want to hear your stories of quitting. Want to know how they turned out? Did it take multiple tries or a time to work up to it? Whatever it was, did you come back to it anyway? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anya Stremian is a deputy editor in the Styles section of the New York Times. She edited their project there called I Quit, 20 people who walked away from their jobs, their religion, their relationships, and even this assignment. Anya, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi. Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I love this theme, and I never would have thought, you know, you talk about people quitting their jobs or, you know, one realm of life. What led you into this idea, this overall theme of quitting anything?
Well, I've personally always been fascinated by the act of quitting whenever I've been in situations, professional or personal, that have made me feel trapped. Just the mere idea that I could quit has provided tremendous relief. So 99% of the time I don't actually quit, but just going through that thought exercise has helped. So by extension, I really love other people's quitting stories. And as I started to gather them at dinner parties and, you know, from friends and colleagues, I thought there was probably a package here. And based on the response, I think everyone sort of loves entertaining the idea. It provides a lot of catharsis.
And yeah, clearly a lot of people at some point in their life are going to quit something. This is whatever right. Our personal quit might be. This is a common theme of humanity.
That's right. And I don't think it should be seen as an act of failure, even though that's what we're sort of brought up to believe. I think it's an act of self-care, of empowerment, of taking back your time. And, you know, thematically, it feels right for January because that's when we're sort of taking on new things or getting rid of bad things.
When you talk to people about quitting, I mean, because it has a certain stigma to it, just the word, did people seem a little ashamed at first to share their stories or did they embrace their quit?
Actually, it was both. What I realized in surveying all these stories was that it can either be an impulsive act of emancipation, or it can be a sort of more tortured, often very tortured, many, many months and steps and thoughts toward, you know, a decision. And so it often doesn't come easy. Sometimes it does, but people rarely regret it. And the one common theme was just this tremendous sense of relief when it was done.
Yeah, the stories are so different and the things people quit are so different that it's hard to find common themes that fit everywhere. But another thing that in going through all these stories, a really common thing that seemed to happen was the thing people quit, whether it was dating apps or sex or a job or whatever, they realized that it freed them up to appreciate something else or follow a new path. They kind of took out some dead wood and found all these things opening up for them.
That's exactly right. You know, they were able to pursue the things that didn't drain them. So there's a lot to be said for freeing that mental space.
We're talking about quitting anything, jobs, relationships, habits, you name it. Anya Estremian is with us from the New York Times. They did a project there. She edited it. It's called I Quit, 20 People Who Walked Away from Their Jobs, Their Religion, Their Relationships, and Even This Assignment. You can join in if you have a story to share about something you quit at some point in your life. You can call 800-642-1234. Anya, I want to get a taste of some of the stories that you shared here. I love this one. I quit my smartphone. This is by contributor Lisa Wells. Can you share a little bit of her story with us?
Sure. So like so many of us, she realized that she was sort of drifting off, that she wasn't present. Her husband would often ask, you know, where did you go while I was speaking? And she had no idea where she went, but she knew it was nowhere good. She lost her ability to read, to write, to focus. And that was unfortunate because she is a writer. And so she tried moderation first. She tried going for walks and leaving her phone at home. But that didn't work because she felt this nagging feeling of there's going to be something waiting for me when I get home, or I'm missing something in my pocket. So she remembered the last time she quit something really hard, which was cigarettes, and she used the Alan Carr method. So she decided to apply that method to quitting her smartphone, which is just really a hard stop, removing the habit from your life. If you don't do it, you don't crave it. And she found that, you know, it worked. It only took her, she went back to a flip phone. And she found it only took 72 hours to not miss her smartphone. I know.
Okay, that's encouraging on one hand.
Yeah.
It's really frightening on the other hand, though, that it takes a stop smoking manual to cut back on our smartphone use. Does that, frighten you a little?
Of course. And she sort of says that, you know, the designers of both cigarettes and phones have worked to design things that create, you know, cravings. So she argues that the same method can be used to quit both.
And then another story. We've got full phone lines, by the way. We're going to go to our college in just a minute. I want to get another story from the series, though. A 23-year-old living, I think it was in Chicago, had a piece called I Quit Buying Things, changing his habits as, I think, he as a consumer. Can you tell us about that one?
Oh, my goodness. I loved this story. He is a Catholic worker in Chicago. And growing up as a child, he was just extremely aware of the things he did not need. When he got Christmas presents, he would sometimes say, you know, accept them and then afterwards say to his mom, I'm really grateful, but I really don't need this. Can we return it? And I don't know many children who do that. So that's incredibly virtuous. He really found his calling working with people in need and living in this Catholic worker home. And so he only receives a stipend. It was previously $100 a month. Now it's $200 a month. And he has to get really creative with how he spends how he makes things last. And he said that his fiance is very understanding and that she supports him emotionally, not financially.
That might be a harder one to pull off for a lot of people. I know a lot of people are, try to simplify and go minimal and things like that. Is this something you could see other people learning from?
Absolutely. I mean, his case is a pretty extreme one. He's probably a better person than I. But I think there are certainly lessons to be taken in there, which is that we need to learn to reuse the items we have.
Let's go to our callers with stories about quitting something in their lives. Andre starts us off in Madison. Andre, hi.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Andre?
Yeah, I think this is an awesome topic. I experienced it myself about 6 months ago, whereas there was a period of time where, because of a high-profile job that I was in, you start going through, anxiety and depression and you're stressed out and you can't sleep and you want to do well, in your place of employment. But at the same time, it comes to a point where you have to really do some self-reflection and say, this isn't healthy for me, and if you can afford it financially, you just have to take some time off and just really just work on yourself and just make sure that your family is on the right page. And, that worked for me. And about a month ago, I became gainfully employed again. And I would recommend it. I think everybody should plan for the unexpected. So, it's all about when they say pay yourself first. You have to be prepared for if those situations do come up that you can walk away.
And Andre, I want to ask before we let you go. I once left a job I wasn't happy in, and the moment after I quit, I had this huge sense of relief. I think of former House Speaker John Boehner the day he announced his resignation. I've never seen a happier face. Did you feel that sense of relief, Andre, when you locked that decision in?
I did. Words cannot express. I mean, it just got to a point where, it just felt like, just a heavy burden was lifted. And I truly felt it, and I truly started feeling happy, started getting myself back, and it just got to a point where, and I'm just being transparent, you just start weaning yourself off of any of the medications that were prescribed to you during that time.
Wow. Andre, thank you so much for sharing that. That reminds me of a story, Anya, one of your contributors shared, of somebody who had achieved what they thought they wanted in life, the drummer for the band The Black Crowes. Was one of your stories of quitting. Can you share that with us? Because that Andre totally reminded me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the drummer for the Black Crowes, Steve Gorman, really saw he always wanted to be part of a successful band. Anyone who drums does. You don't want to be part of an unsuccessful band. And he found that with the Black Crowes. But I guess increasingly there was dysfunction within the band. This is pretty well documented. He was just miserable. He had a really hard time quitting. He tried many times. He kept sort of getting sucked back in. As he said, it's really hard to go back to flying coach. He finally did leave and, focused on family life and felt really good. But eventually he really missed having that sense of purpose. And unlike, a lot of other fields, when you're a drummer, there are just fewer job opportunities. So he did end up going back. And eventually the band disbanded. However, they are going back. They're going back on tour this summer, but not with him. So he has made the break permanent.
Andre, thanks for sharing your story. We are talking to Anya Stremian, deputy editor in the Styles section of the New York Times. She edited the project we're talking about. It's called I Quit, 20 people who walked away from their jobs, their religion, their relationships, even this assignment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story about quitting something, a habit, maybe smoking, maybe something else unhealthy, a job, a relationship, something in your life you decided it needs to stop? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what it was and how it went. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Anya Stremian, deputy editor in the Styles section of the New York Times. She edited the project, I Quit, 20 people who walked away from their jobs, their religion, their relationships, and even this assignment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you quit something in your life that was a big deal, a habit you stopped, a job you left? How'd you feel about it? How did you make it work? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go back to your calls now. Rob is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Rob, hi.
Hi. You said a minute ago that if you decide to quit something, or if you have decided to quit something, you just go ahead and do it. You don't just decide to quit smoking and go ahead and do it. I smoked for more than 50 years, and I had wanted to quit for about 10 years, and I simply could not do it. And the only way I was finally able to is that it landed me in the hospital with pneumonia.
Wow.
And after I got out of the hospital, it was there for a week, I never had another cigarette again. But without that extreme experience, I would have never been able to stop. So I want to warn anybody who's smoking who thinks, well, I'm smoking now, I'm young, it's not hurting me, I can just stop anytime. BS.
Rob, thanks so much for sharing that story. I'm sorry you were hospitalized. I'm glad you have been able to quit smoking after a while. Anya, smoking, there wasn't a direct essay about that, but that, I think, in our culture, that's, I think if we had a Family Feud question, a thing you quit, smoking would be up at the top of the list.
Absolutely. And Rob's point, and I'm so glad he did quit smoking, so congratulations, Rob. But to his point, it's like sometimes our bodies tell us something, even if our minds can't make a decision. I think Andre also spoke about anxiety and depression, and it was really his body telling him that he hated this job and needed to leave it. In Rob's case, it was much more physical. But that was a theme that emerged in a lot of these essays, is sometimes if our minds are indecisive, our body is sending all the signals, and we should listen.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Bill now with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Good afternoon. And Anya, you are the voice of liberation.
Thank you.
I was a career teacher, and teachers just don't quit. We just don't. And I taught for 20 years in one district, 5 years in another, half a year in another, and then I quit. I'm not good at retirement. I went back, and I tried it again. The children had mutated. I spent all of my time on the sit down, shut up, don't talk to me that way, get out, you know. It was starting to affect my health. I was 60-some years ago, years old at the time. I dreaded every morning. It was hard to quit, but I did. And the very next Monday, when I woke up, I heard birds. I saw the sun. My body said, even if we don't have any money, thank you for saving my life.
Wow. Okay, Bill, thank you for sharing that. A powerful story there, Anya. He tried to get out, but he kept coming back in. But he finally, it sounds like, got away from it, Anya.
And he saw the birds and the blue skies, and that sounds pretty euphoric.
Yeah,
but it's a wonderful, noble profession. So,
right. I mean,
you
I think that's
service.
Well, that's a conflict there that people might have the thing they're trying to quit. If it is, you know, they see something valuable in it versus their own well-being. That is a unique challenge. It's this valuable service, but it's hurting them as it was in Bill's case. That makes it a little tougher on you.
Exactly. And I'm interested in that moment where the switch is flipped and you just realize this is what I have to do for self-preservation. It's amazing how we can take care of ourselves when it comes down to it.
Bill,
it's empowering.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Anya Stremian with the New York Times, editor of a project called I Quit, 20 people who walked away from their jobs, their religion, their relationships, and even this assignment. And before we go back to our callers, Anya, I want to talk to you about that last one. You ended up contributing an unplanned piece about quitting to the series.
I know. Had I known that my emails would be published or that I would publish my own emails, I would have made them much more literary. Yeah, it was pretty pathetic. I spoke to this writer about this particular assignment. I got very excited about it. This writer was very excited about it. But eventually that writer just ghosted me, and I sent about 4 unanswered emails over the course of several weeks following up, like, hi, how's it going? You can have an extension. And I was basically begging. And I don't usually do that, but I was particularly invested in this piece, and it just didn't come to fruition. But the piece about her, about the person quitting the assignment, did. So I got something out of it.
So they quit their assignment about quitting. Very meta.
Exactly.
Let's go back to our callers. Jeannie is with us now in Sun Prairie. Jeannie, hello.
Oh, hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jeannie?
Oh, last summer I had an epiphany, and I just decided I wanted to make a change. And then I went to a global leadership summit, and that just cemented it. I realized I wasn't living my best life, and I quit my job. And I'm still not employed, but I'm about to start a new adventure in a passionate job, and I don't regret it one bit. It's like, yeah, I don't have as much money, but guess what? I have my dignity, and I have my grandchildren, and I've been able to do the things that I was missing out on for the last 4 years. And so I don't know if you can do it, if you can get through the financial struggles. I say go for it, because life is too short. Hey, and guess what? I am a silver sneaker.
Jeannie, thank you so much for calling and sharing that story. She used that word epiphany, Anya, and I think there were at least a few of the stories in the project you edited where people had, you know, some of them were long-term processes. Some of them had hit them in a day.
That's right. I know. And I'm extremely interested in that. I'm also interested in the fact that she and another caller talked about the financial burden, because obviously quitting is, especially a job, is a financial mm-hmm. burden to most of us. Both callers talked about how it was worth it, how the scaling back was worth it, because they still had their dignity. So I think that's a really interesting thing to note.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jamie now in Madison. Jamie, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm having such a great time listening to other people's quitting stories, because I've been struggling with my quitting story for the last 3 years. Because there is some regret that comes with it, especially if, just like one of your other callers, you were a teacher and you came to the reality that you just couldn't do it anymore. I think it points to a bigger problem in our society with teaching. It is a noble cause, and I was a good teacher, and I loved my job. I loved the kids, but I was drained at the end of the day, and I had to have a second job because my teaching job wasn't paying me enough. And one day, after a rough evaluation, I was laying on the couch staring at the ceiling, and I realized to myself, I couldn't do this anymore.
And wow.
Jamie, thanks for sharing
that epiphany.
Story. Yeah, again. And Anya, I wonder, can the rest of us, even if we're not quitting, it seems like we can maybe learn lessons from people who quit. Like, we've heard from a couple teachers. Maybe there's lessons there for schools or a magazine editor in the case of one of your stories. Maybe we should be reviewing right. these stories of people who left our jobs or relationships with us and learn something about ourselves.
Oh, my goodness. Burnout is a huge issue in so many different professions. So that's definitely something that employers should evaluate. And I know many workplaces are.
Now, since you've done, in our last couple of minutes, Anya, since you've done this project, are you hearing from a lot of people, either in your daily life or from readers sharing their stories? Is this something that there's a taste for people to talk about?
So many people. I know that how much it resonates with me personally, but I just cannot believe how this project has resonated with readers, your listeners, with New York Times commenters, and with my friends. It's wild. I think maybe I'm not alone in enjoying other people's quitting stories. There's something very liberating about hearing them, if not doing it.
Well, it seems like, I don't know, I haven't seen other projects like this. Do we need to spend more time on this, I don't know, the science of quitology in our society to understand just what we're getting a hint at here?
Honestly, I could do this full time.
Well, maybe there's a book we'll talk to you about in the future. What do you think?
I would love it.
Okay. Don't quit your job to do it, though. You can keep doing more features like this.
No, I won't. I love the New York Times.
Anya, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
We've been talking to Anya Stremian, deputy editor in the Styles section of the New York Times. She edited the project I Quit, 20 people who walked away from their jobs, their religion, their relationships, even this assignment. You can keep sharing your stories of quitting. Thanks to the callers who we didn't have time to get to, so we had to quit before we got you on the air. You can keep sharing your stories of quitting, whatever it might be, a job, a habit. Maybe it was smoking, as we heard from one of our callers and a couple other people have mentioned on Facebook. Maybe quitting living in a place, a relationship, you name it. Was there a lesson, a life lesson that you learned along the way? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or as always, head over, share your thoughts and see what other people have to say. You can do that at the Ideas Network Facebook page. The Super Bowl is coming up, and that means Super Bowl parties, and those have Super Bowl party snacks, which leads in turn to lots of guacamole. And that means, according to some reports, an increased risk of avocado-related hand injuries. Central Time producer Tim Peterson is with me. This has been on your mind. You sent me an article about this.
Actually, I believe that was our producer, Bill.
Oh, that's right.
Sorry, but I have read the article, if it, you know, helps.
Right, and you cut an avocado this morning. Well, let's talk about what happens here. People hold the avocado in their hand after they cut it in half.
And they try to get the pit out by slamming the knife into the pit and wrenching it out, which tends to work pretty well.
And it works, but we've seen reports, orthopedics or, you know, plastic surgeons and stuff having to do reconstructive surgery for all the people who've cut their hands cutting avocados.
Right. It's definitely a threat. You know, in one of the things that stood out to me from the article was this idea that you need to be patient when you cut an avocado. You can't be rushing. You're making this guac. You're in a hurry, preparing for the Super Bowl. Make sure you have enough time to cut the avocados.
Now, hold on. You cut an avocado, you told me this morning.
I did.
Safely, but you did it with the holding it in your hand and slamming the knife method. Do I have this right?
I did. And, you know, I've been waking up earlier and earlier to catch my bus to get into work on time and also prepare breakfast with enough time to cut that avocado with patience.
Okay. Authorities recommend put it on the cutting board. Slam the knife down there if you have to slam a knife, or
use a spoon.
Use a spoon, though you lose some avocado that way. It's true. Avocado news you can use. This is Central Time.